you.
You don't have to wear this.
I don't want to. Second. Okay. Good evening. My name is Hatzia. I am an addict and alcoholic. And the last four times I was here, we talked about step one through four. Today is about step five, and about the tradition number five. What I've tried to do is look at the steps in such a way that the traditions make sense as well. Usually traditions are either not touched upon or just only read a couple of times, but they're not really talked about. And I look at the traditions as a framework designed specifically within which Alcoholics Anonymous can do its work. It is a set of ideas within which we have the freedom to do what's necessary for us to find a new life. Step five and tradition five are no exception to that. Although if you read the fifth step and if you read the fifth tradition, it may not necessarily make sense that they belong together, but they do. And hopefully I'll be able to illuminate that. Step five says, admitted to God, to ourselves, and other human being the exact nature of our wrong. Actually, wrongs. And tradition five says, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So if we look at the fifth tradition, and we say, okay, to the alcoholic who still suffers, what message do we have to carry? What is this message? Is it a message of sobriety? Is it a message of a better life? Is it a message of a new God? Or is it a message of finding a God? Is it a message of Jesus Christ, of Allah, or Buddha, or whatever? What is this message? And it is not necessarily clear anywhere what this message is. And I think it's a personal thing, whatever message we have. But there is one overriding principle. Whatever message we give to the alcoholic that still suffers is a message that there is a way out of hell. There is a way out of hell. You do not have to live this way any longer. There is a way out. Why? Because we've done it. All of us. Look around us. Any meeting I go to, the evidence is clear. There's a preponderance of evidence everywhere I go that this thing works. And it works on a general way, the same for everybody, but everybody does it differently, which is the beauty of AA. We can do our work our way within a certain framework which is designed for us to give the freedom, to find a lifestyle that is better, that where we can be productive, free, and happy, and don't have to kill ourselves and be an absolute terror to our people that are next to us. So whatever that message is, whatever it is, it could be this, what I'm doing. It could be the guy going to a hospital and working with an alcoholic who is Baker-acted and sitting next to him and say, you know what, there's a way out. How would you like to feel unencumbered and have no fear, have no guilt, and you don't have to drink? How would you feel? To most of us, that whole idea was alien. Not that I hadn't been there, but the idea that I actually could do it was different. I didn't have that idea. I've been to Phoenix House, I've been to treatment facilities, I've been to psychiatrists, psychologists, I've been in group therapies and personal therapies, I've been in primal screen, gestalt, I mean, you name it, I've done them all. And none of them worked. None of them worked until I came to AA. And it's not that I didn't know about AA, I knew about AA since the early 70s. I've known about AA for a long time. I just didn't think it was for me. I was a little too cool. I was an addict, first of all. That's what they told me. I was diagnosed an addict in the early 70s, 1970, 71. And then I went to Phoenix House and I became an addict in treatment. And then when I came out of Phoenix House, 3 years later, I was a recovered addict. Actually, I was an ex-addict. And I had a little piece of paper that says ex-addict. I wish I could find it. I would frame it. What that meant is that it's X. It's done. It's over. I'm treated. I'm cured. I'm fine. I'm well. I have no more problems. So I drank. the day I got out. I did. I drank the day I got out. And you know what? This is Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about alcohol. Very, very few of us have only done alcohol. There are a few of those. One of them, my sponsor, that only done alcohol. But most of us have done other things. But my day started with alcohol and ended with alcohol. My journey started with alcohol and ended with alcohol. I remember the day that I went to my first AA meeting in 1985, I had a perfectly good bottle of vodka. It was about this full. And I threw it out. And it occurred to me, after all those years of drinking and using, for some reason I got it down to half a bottle. That's pretty good. I just bought enough to get a half, and I threw away the half a bottle, and I thought, that's a good half a bottle, it's going away. Mm-mm-mm. But that was my last thing. So, what is this message that we carry to other alcoholics? It's a message of hope. It's a message that there is a future, that we do not have to suffer, that we can get away from the insanity and the craziness that our life became. And you know what's funny about it? I didn't even think my life was that insane. I didn't even think that it was out of control. You know, I surrounded my people that were the same, if not worse. So I looked pretty good. You know, I didn't look that bad. It's when my face was pointed at it, this is what you're doing, that I realized, you know, that's not normal. It's just not normal to take drugs and alcohol at huge quantities and thinking you're okay. It's not normal, but we did it, all of us. So we carry this message to the alcoholic who is still suffering. Does that mean he is still using or drinking? Maybe. Mostly not, though. It's obvious that the one who is still using and drinking is suffering. But there are so many of us that come in, that stop drinking, that stop using, that get physical sobriety, who are still suffering. And that's the message that has to be carried as well, that there is a way out of that suffering. There is a way to get out of this. There is a way to find a new world. It's one thing to leave the bottle alone. It's an entirely different thing to get emotional sobriety. And what these steps give us, has given me, is emotional sobriety. I'm not saying that I have it, but I've got some of it. And I know where to get more. And I know the work involved that I have to do to get more. I know what I should not do. I've been taught these things, and I keep doing those things. The message was not wasted on me. The taste that I got of this emotional sobriety only gave me the feeling that I want more of it. And the taste, whatever that taste is, it translates itself into a sense of serenity, a sense of peace, a sense of being okay with the world, a sense of humility. The fifth step is the first step that teaches humility. The fourth step, you do with yourself. It doesn't mean much in that sense. You have to do the work. But the fifth step, we share with ourselves, with God and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. What does humility mean? What is humility? Humility means, as far as I'm concerned, to know one's place in context of the world. To know my wrongs. To know my wrongs, to know who I am in context to you. I am no bigger, no smaller. I am who I am. I respect where you stand, where I stand. Respect is a substantial feature of humility. And I know that I had none of that. I was a big mouth. I used to pride myself in the fact that I was the most obnoxious guy I knew. I was. And I was proud of it too. And I'd prove it to you. And I had no respect for whatever other people thought. Whatever question I was asked, I knew the answer to. And if you thought you had a bigger answer, I would trump you, usually in a different language, because you wouldn't answer. But the whole idea of the fifth step is we use what we looked at in the fourth step, and we incorporate it. We now give it out. And we share it with somebody else. This sharing of our wrongs with somebody else is an age-old feature. It has been around for ages. It used to be actually a public confession. Public confession was, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, the most powerful tool for a society to stay together. Because people would know each other, they would know their wrongs, a public confession would bring immediate humility to the person who confessed to their sins, and redemption was given at that moment. That's the beauty of confession. Those who do not wish to let go of their secrets cannot prosper. They cannot. Those who wish and give out their secrets and their sins will find mercy. I like that. I like all about that. It was wasted on me when I did my first step. Excuse me. Because I had no clue what that was about. I had no clue what I would talk about. The first step for me was just get in this program and find a way not to have to drink, not to have to use. Please, tell me how it's done. And I was told some specific rules to follow, and that's what I did. And in time, when I started doing the steps, things started to make sense. And as time progressed, they start making more sense and more and more. And even now, I'm still finding things in the steps that I did not find before. I got 25 years clean and sober, and I'm still finding things. And I said, you know what? I never saw that. I never really understood the finesse of that particular point. Like, for example, that the fifth step is the beginning to humility. Only in the seventh step do we find the word humble. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Only in the seventh step. Not before. Because before, we don't know what humility is. It starts here. It starts with looking inside and finding what it is that I do that caused my hell. So the fifth tradition, I'll go back to the fifth tradition. The suffering that I had before I came here was entirely different from the suffering that I had when I came here, when I finally ended up here, and when I when I was abstinent and I was removed in time from my symptom. My suffering was one of psychological, emotional suffering. I had no clue how to deal with the world. I had no clue how to deal with my wife, or my son, or my parents. I had no clue how to have friends or keep friends. I had no clue how to be honest with myself or anybody else. I had to be taught these things so that I could start finding out that life is different from what I thought it was. My suffering was one that we all suffer from, which is a suffering of ignorance. We come here, we take away the drugs and the alcohol, and we think we've got it licked. Believe me, it's just the beginning. It's just the beginning of a road of sobriety that is going to take many different turns. It's going to take many different ideas. It's going to take many different sessions and many different people. Many different people in your life who are going to tell you what to do and what not to do. Some you listen to, some you won't. Some sound crazy, some are not. Some sponsors you like, some you won't. Some you fire, some will fire you. But my sponsor said an interesting thing. I still have this sponsor. He says, the bottle comes in many disguises. And I like that because it explained to me my behavior. If it was not alcohol or dope, it'd be a girlfriend or girlfriends or sex, or it would be food, or it would be money or showing off money, or it would be anything not to feel the way I feel. Anything. And that's the suffering I talk about. Because how can I feel at peace if I can't feel myself? It's impossible. So when we say to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, it's not just a message of hope. It's a teaching that we do amongst ourselves. It's a teaching of principles and ideas that work. And some work better than others. And sometimes it's said in such a way that it makes sense to you, and sometimes it's not. Which is why we go, at least I, go to many different meetings to hear the same thing over and over again and dressed in a different jacket. It just sounds different and it's palatable to me. Another thing that I like about alcoholics, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm talking about me. Because the moment you tell me what to do, sorry, you lost me. I'm not interested. And that's my defiant me. Is it right or wrong? I don't really care. It just is. It's probably wrong. But I know that that is a way in which we approach each other. I talk about me. I tell what works for me. I explain what I have done so that I and how I got a good result. This way you can take it or leave it. It's either yours or it's not. It's entirely up to you. So the fifth tradition says our primary purpose is to carry the message. What that entails is that without the fifth tradition, without the primary purpose to carry the message, AA would not exist. It is the bottom line of what we do. Life of AA, livelihood of AA as an institution depends on the fifth tradition. It depends on us working with somebody else. It depends on the idea that if I've been given this gift of sobriety, I cannot hold on to it unless I give it away. And yesterday I gave this example, and I'll do it again today. This glass is about this full. You know, you're going to think I'm going to say, is it half full or half? No, it's not. I'm not going to say that. My question is this glass heavy? Is it heavy? Well, no, it's not. Ask me again in an hour, standing like this. It's heavier. Ask me in 2 hours. It's heavy. Ask me in 4 hours. My arm hurts. That's how heavy it is. Ask me in 6 hours. My arm is lame and I don't think I can keep it up. That's how heavy it is. Ask me in 8 hours. The glass will be on the floor. That's how heavy it is. Sobriety is like this. I can carry sobriety on my own just for so long. I cannot carry it on my own. It's easy when I come in and I take away the dope and the alcohol. It's easy because, man, it's a new freedom. Whoa. But then we get bored with it. At least I did. I got bored with it because the novelty wore off. And all of a sudden, it wasn't that easy anymore. Or fun. All of a sudden, it wasn't, I have to go to another meeting. I have to talk to my sponsor. I have to call my sponsor. All of a sudden, the whole idea that was so great, that saved my life, was not such a great idea anymore. Why? Because I carried it all alone. I refused to reach out and ask somebody, how does it feel to you? What did you do when you felt this way? How do you deal with the fact when you get pissed off at meetings and you don't want to go? What do you do? Or just go to a meeting anyway and listen to what people say. I would listen to the guys that had 3 months and would talk about how bad their day was. And how they showed up anyway. And I think, you know what? Like I said earlier, at another time we're here, I picked up that jewel that was meant just for me. And there's always one in a meeting. There's always a jewel like that. Sobriety is like that cup. It's easy in the beginning. It's easy to hold up. But I cannot hold it up if I don't get help. It's impossible. People say it's willpower. No, it's not willpower. It really isn't. It's a system we do amongst us. It's like saying, if I have working a diarrhea attack with willpower, how long will that last? I think I talked about that, didn't I? Yeah.
Overshare.
Yeah. So, the whole idea of what we have to do, the whole idea of what I do in my program is I try to give back what was given to me. And I have to do this. Whether I like it or not is not an issue. Whether I feel like it is not the point. I do know this. I like, and you know what? It is not even a selfless thing to do. It isn't. Because I do get something out of it. And I do it because the result is something that is tangible for me. My sobriety stays alive. Whether my message reaches you, or you, doesn't even matter in a way. I would like it to, but I did my part, and I will stay sober as a result of it. I like that. I like what sobriety has done to me. I like the life it's given to me. I like the benefits of it. I like the serenity. I like the meditations. I like all of it. I would like to use a little too sometimes. I would like to drink. I remember when my parents died. Big deal. My parents died in a car accident 11 years ago or so. I went to Holland. That's where I'm from. It was a big deal. There were lots of people, and it was like heavy and difficult. And finally, the funeral was done. We come back to the house, and there's like 20 bottles of wine. My father was a big wine drinker. 20 bottles of wine. And my brother gets this big, beautiful wine glass and fills it up with red wine. And I always liked red wine. I started with red wine. And he said, "Here, take one." And you know what? I thought, this is, my parents just died. I'm far away from my sponsor. This is, nobody knows. And I told my brother, I said, "Vanald, I can't. I don't drink." And this is what he said. He said, "You still don't drink?" And I said, "Yes, correct. I still don't drink. I still don't." I was bothered by that. I didn't like the fact that he pushed it on me and didn't recognize where I was. But it's not his job to recognize where I'm at. It's not his disease. It's mine. He is not suffering from alcoholism. I am. I'm a recovering alcoholic. He is not. In his mind, recovered means that I can drink a little. Why? Because that makes sense to him. It just absolutely makes no sense to me. Why would I want a little? It's ludicrous. It's stupid. You know, I mean, I'd start there and I'd be looking for the marching powder. You know, so. But he doesn't have to understand that point. He doesn't. And I don't have to go out and explain it to him. It's not an issue. All I have to say, "No, thank you. Appreciate it." And I'll get pissed off. But I got a Copton attitude and then I got over it. So, life of AA depends on the fifth tradition. You think it's a coincidence that the fifth tradition is next to the fifth step? That it supports the fifth step? Perhaps the fifth step is of absolute, total importance of our own emotional sobriety. It is certainly where it starts. It is certainly the step where we start looking inside ourselves. You know, when I grew up, nobody taught me how to deal with anger, how to deal with fear, how to deal with sadness, how to deal with when a girl broke up with me, how to deal with stuff that happened to me at home. There were more secrets in my house than there were not secrets. It was crazy. You know, and on the outside, everything looked good. It drove me nuts. But nobody sat down and explained to me, this is what emotions are, and this is how you deal with them, and this is how you answer. This, all I knew was hurt, fear, anger. Usually in that progression. And you were not going to see my pain. You were certainly not going to see my fear. Nobody was going to see that I was afraid. Actually, I was more afraid seeing the fear myself than you were going to see it. I was so afraid that you were going to see that I thought, anyway, you get the point. I would get myself really screwed up about this whole thing. So the fifth step is the first time, even though I had all these treatments and facilities and doctors and learned people and all these people that had worked at me and on me and with me and for me, the fifth step was the first time that I sat down with somebody like me and said, "This is what happened to me." Or, "This is my resentment because Johnny did this and it made me feel like that. And my part of it was this, and I could have prevented it like that." And it started with Johnny, who stole $10. And it ended up talking about what happened to me at home when I was a child. That was not in my first, fourth, and fifth step. That was in my fifth or the sixth that I did with my sponsor when I had 14 years of sobriety. The point is this. It doesn't stop once you've done it once. It didn't stop for me. I had to do it again and again and again and again. And sometimes something happens, and I'm totally screwed up by it, and I call my sponsor, and he says, do a fourth and a fifth of it. Write down your resentment. Analyze what it is you resent. Which part of you got hurt? Your manhood, your ego, your image? Which part of you got hurt? And what did you to cause it? What did you do to cause it? And what can you do about it? And I always find an answer. Always. The point is this. A fifth. We learn these steps in sequence. But life doesn't happen in sequence. Life happens. Here's an eighth step, then a tenth, then a fourth and a fifth, and then shut up, do the first step again. You know, that's just, life happens that way. So, it's no coincidence that the fifth tradition says that without the fifth tradition, AA would perish. Without the ability for me to look inside of me and to find the nature of my wrongs, I will perish. I will not survive. There are two emotions in a person's life that are absolutely destructive. There are two emotions that do not tell me who I am, but they tell me who I'm not. It's guilt and it's shame. Four and five deals with guilt and shame. Eight and nine deals with guilt and shame. And the reason why it's so important, I believe, to do these steps is because guilt and shame are the two emotions that tell me what I'm worthy of. They tell me that I'm worthy of good things or bad things. If I'm full of guilt, I am not worthy of good things because I'm guilty. If there is many things in my past, and I see myself and I remember myself, and my self-image is one of shame because of things that have happened to me that I've not cleared up, and I'm shameful, then whatever happens to me cannot be other than shameful. We do not get what we deserve. That's the saying, you get what you deserve. We don't. We actually get what we feel we are deserving of. And what we are deserving of depends on the amount of guilt and shame that's in my life. So if I work at eliminating guilt and shame, automatically my future prospects will clear up. I am then allowed, or I can allow myself, to prosper. How this works, I don't know. I just know it does, because I've felt it. I've lived it. I have sat with my sponsor, and I've talked about things that nobody was going to know. Nobody. This wasn't even the blacklist. This was beyond the blacklist. I was not going to talk about this. And I talked about how I felt and what happened. And I talked about how I was treated and what it did to me. And the fact that I could, the fact that I was capable to do that, was amazing. And what it did to me was amazing. It changed the way I looked at the perpetrators, and it changed the way I looked at myself. I could forgive. Not forget. I could forgive. And realize this is an axiom of life. Nobody does anything with the intent to hurt themselves. Think about it for a second. The person who commits suicide, you say, well, he's hurt himself. It hurts less than the hurt he's feeling. Nobody does anything with the intent to hurt themselves. What happened to me? It wasn't my fault. I was just there. I was just present. But in the end, it became my fault because I used it as an excuse. I used it as a reason not to have to look at myself. I used it as a reason to reject other people in my life. I used it as a reason to cheat on my wife. I used it as a reason not to be honest. I used it as a reason to push people away. Those were my choices, nobody else's. So I had to deal with that. And the only way I could is by talking about it. talk about it with somebody who could understand. And there is somebody who lives here in this town who knows everything about me. That's pretty cool. And he loves me. He's my sponsor. That's a cool thing. Actually, my wife knows too. And she still loves me. How about that? You know? What a gift. You invite guilt and shame, you will drink again. It's a little rhyme that I like, because it's the absolute truth. So what does this fifth step, what does the process do aside from opening us up to ourselves, to God and another human being? I find that the other human being is the most important of the three, because that's where the miracle happens. It's between you and I. That's where it occurs. So what does this step do? It gives, and it gave me, the freedom to choose who I am. What I mean with that is, I had no clue of not only who I was. I had no idea how I came across. Nor did I have an idea of how to act or how to change my acting. I used to carry an image of Mr. Cool. Why? Because I was really afraid that I was just a run-of-the-mill alcoholic, not much to think about. Just not cool. That was my fear. I used to be extraordinarily arrogant because I was afraid you'd think I was stupid. These images, these ego projections, these things, I had no control over. They were the result of my own fears. They were the result of my own inadequacies. And a rule about an image that I project or that somebody projects is that it always protects the opposite. Somebody walks in like Enrico Suave. He's afraid he's not. Woman walks in, totally sexy, decked out. She's afraid she's sexually inadequate. Many guys are like that too. Somebody walks in with a chest like that. First of all, says, you do not get any closer. But it means too, if you get closer, you're going to find out that I'm really small inside. You're not going to see that, because I'm really big. It's those images that when we have control over them, we can choose who we want to be instead of the image choosing who I am. A clear example of an image being in charge of a person is when the person says, well, I just had to act that way. I mean, I couldn't do anything else, or stuff like, that's just how I am. You know, no, it's not how you are. You can choose who you are. You can choose how you act. There's work involved. And the problem that I always got in is because I did not have the ability to look at myself as I was living my life and see who I was and what I was and how I acted. Instead, I looked at you and blamed you for it. The fifth step was the first time that I could actually look at myself and realize how I always got into the same trouble over and over again in every different place that I was, because I did certain things. My image, my way of acting, my way of talking to you, my way of putting you down, my way of hitting you, my way of cutting you off, whatever it was, always caused the same problem. And I thought that I had no control over these reactions because you are the one who provoked me. It's your fault. A resentment is an attitude that says that what's wrong with me is your fault. And as long as my problem is outside of me, then so is my solution. As long as my solution is outside of me, then there is no solution. The fifth step taught me that my problem is inside of me. And as the problem is inside of me, so is the solution. Because I do have control over me. Serenity Prayer is very clear about that. I have control over what I can do and what I cannot do. So, the fifth step is the first part in this program, after the first three steps of preparation, where we actually delve inside and try to look at who we are and what we are, and try to make a change. Every time I did the fifth step, the moment after the fifth step, when I just sat alone and just was quieted my mind and thanked my higher power for what was given to me and for what I was able to share, those moments were little pearls. They were little diamonds in my life. They were absolutely quiet and serene. Because for a change, I was not fighting with Hatsi. For a change, the fight stopped. And the noise and the voice in my head stopped chattering and telling me what to do and not to do and how stupid I was and what a moron and that and that and that and that and that. And that. That voice, by the way, has diminished over time. Not only has it diminished, it's changed its tone. That voice used to talk down to me like nobody else. Nobody would talk to me that way, but I did to myself. Oh my God, I would call myself incredible things. Nobody would do that, but I did to me. That is not happening anymore. Because I tell myself, no, you don't talk to yourself that way. It's not happening. And that is the result of working at my own problems. At working at and understanding where I am at fault. I am not the cause. I am the cause of what happens to me, not the victim. The whole idea of being a victim is the whole idea of having a resentment. A victim says, a victim is a person whose perpetrator is not that person. I am the victim because somebody else did this to me. And it's easy sometimes to feel it. Hey, I could feel a victim. I felt a victim all along from what happened to me at home. I felt like a victim all along. That's why it had power over me. That's why I could not do anything about it, because I gave the power away. I gave the power away to my past, to my mother, to my family, whatever. It wasn't mine. The moment I said, it is mine, it happened to me, and I have to decide what to do with it, I took the power back. And I changed my life. That is the message that we should give to a suffering alcoholic. Because it's the end of suffering. It's the end of pain. It's the beginning of a new life. It's a gift that nobody else could have given to me but you. Nobody else. All these other psychologists, psychiatrists, all these other guys. First of all, I didn't want to listen to them. Mm-hmm. I wasn't ready for it. It was when somebody else sat down with me. Somebody who was like me. Who looked me in my eyes and said, stop the BS. And asked me the right questions. That's when things changed. So, in closing, when I came here from South America in 1981, I got really, really, really sick as a result of my drinking and using. I ended up it was in Houston, Texas. I had typhoid fever, I had hepatitis A and B, I had a triple pulmonary embolism, I had three amoebic abscesses on my liver, I had dysentery, and I had malaria. I didn't feel good. And I'm just happy that it happened in Houston. Had it happened in South America, it would have been over. But I was only here 2 weeks when I went to the doctor, and I said, you know, I'm not feeling very well. And anyway, so long story short, my father came to visit me. And he gave me a little booklet. Little booklet. And he said, your mother wrote this when you were in Phoenix House in 1973. And she never felt she could give it to you. But she wants me to give it to you now. Give you an idea of the relationship. She still could not give it to me. She did it through my father. But that's all right. You know. Anyway, I got it. That was in 1981. At 15 years of sobriety, in 2003 it was, so what was that, 22 years later, that book had traveled with me all over the States, all over everywhere. And I knew always exactly where it was. It was lying over there, I was in the closet over here, whatever. It was like this little pile of nuclear waste that I could see, because I did not want to read it. I would open it up and see my mother's handwriting and go, I don't want to read it. I would feel the way I felt when I was with her. My mom died in 1987, and I was relieved. 1978, whatever. And I was relieved when she did. And so I didn't want to read this. And I talked to my sponsor about this little booklet. And he said, why don't you read it? So, I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. So 40 minutes later, I read it. So it took me, what, 22 years and 40 minutes to read that little thing. And what I read in there was my mother talking about how sorry she felt of what she'd done to me. How upset she was that she never said she loved me, and she never did. How sorry she was that she pushed me out of the house. How upset she was that there was never a relationship but a bad one. And she talked about this every day a little bit while I was in Phoenix House. And I couldn't believe what I was reading. I was ready for the worst. And after about 20 pages or so, her last sentence was, I love you. I hope one day you see it fit to forgive me. What a deal. It took me 23 years to suffer, not looking at it, not wanting to look at it, not being able to look at it, maybe. So what is the message we give to each other? We can get out of our suffering. There is a way out. However tied up, however knotted up, however difficult your past may seem, there is a way out. And that's what the fifth step does, through the protection of the fifth tradition. It's one of the gifts that has been given to us. Thank you very much.